Good evening and welcome to the regularly scheduled meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board for the City of Morro Bay. Today is Thursday, December 4th, 2014. Please let the record show we have all members of the board here except for Dana McClish. Dana got a hold of me this afternoon and told me he wouldn't be able to attend tonight, but we still have quorum. We'll start off as we do with a moment of silence. Thank you, and please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Twice in a row. 2 months in a row. All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll now move on to our chair and advisory board member announcements and presentations. I'll start on my right this month, with Mr. Reisner.
About the past week or so, with the able assistance of the Morro Bay Harbor Patrol, who ferried the folks to and from the spit, Morro Bay Beautiful did their semi-annual fall cleanup of the spit. A group did the north end of the spit, and then the Black Hills Gang, as they call themselves, a group of retired gentlemen, did the long, what we call the Long March. That's from Montana de Oro all the way to the South Jetty, which is quite a ways. So thanks to all the participants, and thanks to the Harbor Department for providing some transportation for us.
Thank you, Ron. Anything, Bill? My kid's birthday was last Friday. I have twins, and they turned 11, and we kayaked out to the sand spit. A lot of family members did, and we spent the afternoon there and played football and ran around and just had a fantastic afternoon. So it just reminded me of how grateful I am to be living here in this city. So I wanted to share that with everybody. We live in a very special place.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Times two. That's right. And that's it from me. Lynn?
No comment.
Nothing from Lynn. Alan? And Gene?
Yeah. With these storms that we're going to be getting now for the next several months, make sure that you have your mooring lines tied down tight. You got good chafing gear. It's coming. Over.
Thank you, Gene. And we'll now open up to public comment period. This is for anything that is not on the agenda tonight, or if you can't stay for anything that's on the agenda, you're welcome to speak now. You have 3 minutes to address the board. Actually, there's only one of you, so if you go over a little bit, that's fine. We won't hold
okay.
you exactly to the three. Please speak into the microphone and state your name and city of residence.
Ed Molinari, city of residence, Morro Bay, California. I've been here since 1998. Was a representative at one time.
Ed, I'm sorry to interrupt. So that the folks can hear you at home. There we go. Thank you, Ed.
There we go. Ed Molinari. I was once a representative of the Morro Bay Fuel Dock Corporation, as well as other great things going on here in the Bay. Things are looking a lot better these days, a lot of cleanup. I wanted to bring up a specific issue. I had a collision on my vessel a little over 2 months ago. It was quite an extensive collision. One contractor estimated somewhere around $10,000 to $15,000 of damage without being hauled out. I have asked Becca three times for a collision report, and I haven't received one. If that could be expedited, I would appreciate it. I had an incident in the past with AIS where we also were in quite an extensive collision, and the vessel, in my opinion, was totaled. It was fiberglass and oil canned, and we did not call the Coast Guard. We were actually really jarred at the time, and we didn't get a collision report then either. So this is important to me to make sure we get done for
prepare a collision report?
Actually, I learned a great lesson from being hit by AIS. We did not get on the radio, and we did not call the Coast Guard, and therefore we couldn't prove in one sense that we got hit. I called the Coast Guard immediately, so it's of record, about 2 months ago. And I spoke with the boys in the office in the morning, and they said, talk to Becca. So over the last few months, I have, when I've seen her, brought it up, but it hasn't been presented yet.
Okay. Thank you, Ed.
Okay. Thank you.
See no one else in our galley here for public comment. Public comment is now closed. We'll move on to the consent calendar. Item A1, the approval of minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting held on Thursday, November 6, 2014. I trust you've all had an opportunity to read over the minutes as presented. Are there any changes or edits? Seeing none, I'll look for a motion to approve.
So moved.
I'll second.
Moved by Lynn and seconded by Bill to approve the minutes as presented from November 6, 2014. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That passes unanimously. On to item B, public hearings, reports, and appearances. Item B1, the Harbor Department status report. Our Harbor Director, Eric.
Good evening, Chairman Eccles and Board. So update, fair amount of news to report, a lot of upcoming things and a few things, a little water under the bridge. Recent City Council action on November 11th, a couple City Council meetings ago, the Council voted to approve the Ordinance 588, which made the change to the commercial fishing slip qualifications, where we went from the $1,000 per net ton to $5,000 for 26 foot and under and $10,000 for over 26 feet. Changes, ordinances like that, changes in the municipal code take two hearings at a City Council meeting. The next hearing is next week at the December 9th meeting for final reading and approval of that. So after that, assuming approval, that change will be enacted and we will be looking at taking the fish tickets in a little different light. We've had a few fishermen come in already to supply their tickets, and we've been taking them. You know, the law is the law as it is now. Some, I don't think we've received any that don't meet the old parameters but do meet the new. We've only had a couple bring them in so far, so we'll be looking to get those in December, and going into January is when we really start getting most of those coming in. Also, at the November 11th meeting, the City Council approved a new sublease agreement form, our old standard form. Basically, we have boilerplate forms that we use for all of our subleases and master leases and whatnot, and then modify them as the situation fits. Our old sublease form, the way it was written, at the end, its term follows the same term between the sublessee and the master tenant. So if the sublessee and master had a two-year term, our sublease allowed for a two-year term as well. And then the old form, the way it was written, at the end of that two-year term, technically the sublessee had to reapply and go through the whole reapproval process over again. So we made some changes to the form to allow for renewals rather than going through the whole application and vetting process, provided it's a tenant in good standing and all those other things that we normally look at. In addition to that, the council approved administrative approval of seven subleases on the seven remaining master leases that still require City Council approval. There's not very many left of those, as you can tell by the numbers, 7 out of 30. Our older county leases and our old Pipkin leases, they still required City Council approval of all subleases. The new master lease format allows for administrative approval, basically Harbor Director approval. So we, with just a few of those leases remaining, we went to council to go get sort of a blanket authority to approve those subleases on those old leases, and they approved that as well. So that'll streamline our sublease approval process. Recent events, got a few things coming up here, a few things that have happened. The Morro Bay Surfboard Art Festival is still ongoing. It ended on November 29th. And when I wrote this, it was still ongoing. It went on all month. There were surfboards variously painted and arted up around town in various businesses and locations. Some of them were pretty cool, and I hope everybody got around to go see those. That was an event, month-long event that supported Project Surf Camp in Morro Bay and Bloom, and it ended, the proceeds of which came out of an auction on the 29th back at Fishbones Restaurant. I've not heard what the results of that auction were, but hopefully they made some good money for those projects. Commercial Dungeness crab fishing season opened on November 15th. Recreational season opened November 1st. Both seasons go until June 30th. A couple of our crab boats are relocating down here because they normally fish up, you know, San Francisco Bay North. They're anticipating they'll have another good year here, so we're hoping we have a fair amount of crab out front here, so you should start seeing that stuff showing up in the markets pretty quick. Doing their usual boatside tours. I think this weekend they'll be doing some trips out and doing a mock battle offshore. We did hear initially that they were thinking about getting into the light of boat parade on Saturday night, but it sounds like they're gonna dress the boat up, but they're not, and they're gonna allow people on board during the event, but they're not gonna enter in the event just because the captain's unsure about the harbor and the size and maneuvering that big beast around. So they will be decorated up, which will be nice. So they'll be here through the 8th. So go ahead and take advantage of those dockside tours. And if you want to go out on the ships this weekend, it looks like we're going to have good weather. Light of Boat Parade, which we just mentioned, Saturday the 6th, beginning at 6:30. 4:30 p.m., the Whitecaps Band will be starting to play. Parade kicks off at 6:30. Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus of the South Tee Pier as well. Looks like we're going to have good weather forecast. I think we've got a little weak front coming in tomorrow and some rain that tapers off. And then Saturday looks like we're going to be having a nice evening. So hopefully we'll get some chill air and it'll be proper Christmas style and we'll have the boat parade. Had a number of folks already come in and ask about the application process. So I haven't heard numbers yet, but hopefully we'll have the usual 20 or so boats. Starting in the same location down at Tidelands Park off the launch ramp. Fortunately, it's an oncoming tide, which is good for staging when everyone's lining up and kind of staging to get moving. If it's an outgoing tide and boats are trying to fight the current backwards, that tends to make things a little difficult. But this year, it looks like the tide's going to cooperate. Winter Bird Festival begins January 16th through the 19th. It's a yearly ecotourism event promoting understanding and appreciation of birds and other wildlife. Here in the Central Coast, I know the National Estuary Program gets pretty heavily involved in that, and Audubon and Sierra Club. So lots of events online that you can look to that, too, to participate in some of that. Recreational rockfish season ends December 31st. That's kind of our bread and butter for the trailer boat folks. Commercial rockfish variously opens and closes over the year. I don't know what their seasons are. I think they're open in December or through December as well. But recreational closes on the 31st, which really slows down our launch ramp. It's pretty much a ghost town down there after the 31st. Few intrepid guys will go out there and try to do a little crab fishing and maybe some sand dab fishing. But for the most part, until we open back up on, I think last year, or this 2014, we opened May 1st. Salmon opened April 1st. I'm hearing that Fish and Wildlife, is going to give us another month back to the season. So it may be an April 1st opener for rockfish this year. We'll see. And then the last but not least, the Cayucas New Year's Polar Bear Dip at the Cayucas Pier is happening again, 12 o'clock. We are going to be there in attendance as well with North Coast Ocean Rescue and Cayucas Fire standing by for safety backup. Knock on wood. I've seen some years where there's huge surf and big shore break that creates a lot of mayhem, and I've seen some years where it's just been calm as a lake and 80 degrees. You just never know, so we'll see where that goes, but we'll be there with our patrol vessels and some lifeguard personnel to help out if any water safety is needed. And with that, if there's no questions, the end of my report.
So, I'm doing my best to slim down before the polar bear dip, so we're looking forward to that. I do have I guess it's more of a comment and a question for you, Eric. With regard to the leases, the subleases, for the viewers, I wanted to clarify something. Those subleases are for the properties, not for the slips, correct?
Correct. For the master leases, and I'll just use Marina Square as an example. If somebody wants to go into, you know, Unit F of Marina Square on the northern location, they'd have to have a sublease. When people want to rent a slip from Marina Square, no, they're not coming to us for a sublease. Slips are handled by the lease site.
Right, good. And that seems like a great modification. Was that at the prompting of the Harbor Department? Did you and the business manager take that up to council, or how did that come about?
Yeah, it came through us. We had a couple subleases pending that were on the old leases that required city council approval. And then when we were looking at a couple other subleases up for renewal, we took a good hard look at the form and went, this really requires going back to council. The way we interpreted it, and they had the city attorney look at it and said, yeah, it looks like you should go through the whole reapplication process. So we worked with the city attorney and his helpers from their firm, and they crafted some changes, and we brought those forward.
Great. Well, looks like a good change, so kudos to the department for spearheading that. Any other questions or comments for Eric? Bill?
You know, I've been reading the Telegram Tribune, and there has been a lot of letters written on the hunting season, actually, regarding how people are appalled by the whole situation. Could you clarify, is the hunting season then ends on December 6th and there's no more? That's it? Or is there another hunting season? I mean,
that's my understanding. I'm looking towards Gene because he may know more. That's my understanding. That's the paperwork we've got from Fish and Game.
It seems awful.
Awful short.
Comments of note during the public hearing? I'm sorry, any comments of note from the public during the public hearing?
Not that I could recall. No, I was pretty certain it was a unanimous vote.
Anything else for our harbor director? No? All right. Thank you, Eric. That then concludes item B1, our harbor department status report, and we'll move on to item C, unfinished business. Item C1, review of the Harbor Department Rules and Regulations document and Morro Bay Municipal Code Chapter 15 for Harbor Advisory Board input and direction on revising definitions, something that we've wanted to do for a long time, so I think I'm glad we're doing it. Eric, our staff report, please.
Yeah, thank you. So as you know, we've had an ongoing Rules and Regulations update agenda item that we've had for a few meetings now, and trying to get our clean up our rules and regulations, update them, modernize them, get to things that we need to get at, eliminate things that don't make any sense, and then trying to compartmentalize. I think it started with looking at liveaboard ordinance review a while back, and it kind of morphed into going after some of these things in our municipal code and our rules and regulations. And as we worked up to this from out of our last meeting, we deem that looking at the definitions, which any code or regulation, definitions are always the beginning and kind of lay the groundwork for, you know, what obviously definitions are and what things are and what they mean. So Morro Bay's municipal code definitions in Chapter 15 for the harbor section are not very lengthy. You have as an attachment to your staff report. There's a number of definitions in there, and then there's a half a dozen or so definitions in the liveaboard code 15.40, and then in our Harbor Department rules and regulations, the written rules and regulations, which is also included as an attachment, is defined operable and seaworthy. Beyond that, we have no other rules or no other definitions. Also included in your staff report is a number of excerpts from Santa Barbara's municipal code in terms of their definitions. This is all simply just fodder for consideration. I know I've heard a couple comments from some of our members in the public that have asked, by email or by telephone, what are we going after here? Is this what are we saying we want to go to Santa Barbara's, or are we saying we want to go to some of these ones that Ron Reisner put together? None of the above. They're just all definitions for consideration. There's a lot of other definitions that aren't included in here that we could possibly put in. But this is just existing language and things to choose from to give us a starting point. I certainly don't have any preconceived notions in terms of, which ones are good, bad, or otherwise. What I would like to do as we move forward is look at these definitions one by one here, see if we're good with them. I don't want to try and wordsmith definitions necessarily by a committee of you six and me. I'm happy to try and do that if we can get to that relatively quickly, but I think if we can get content and spirit, and if there are specific language things we'd like to include, that's great. It just kind of depends on how it goes, whether we try and do this by a large committee or not. I guess play it by your definition by definition. But if I can get some direction on these, keep it, throw it out, add this, subtract this. This one from Santa Barbara looks good. This one doesn't, et cetera, et cetera. We'll craft those up, and we'll bring them by city attorney review at a later date as well. And then eventually this and any other changes that we look at in the future in terms of the municipal code rules and regulations and our Harbor Department rules and regulations will all get bundled together to go to city council at some point in the hopefully not too distant future. It depends on how many more meetings it takes us to get through this. So with that, I guess probably the best place to start, and Jeff, unless you have some other ideas on how you'd like to proceed, if we want to just start with our existing definitions in the three different sections and see whether those are good or not, and then move on. If there's any others that pop up as we go, I'm happy to entertain those. I've got the municipal code here as well if we need to reference that. You've got our rules and regulations in here if we need to reference that. See how it goes.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. We can just start off and go page by page with the first three and see if there are any areas there that any board members have comments or suggestions for.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll start off with the first page of definitions. At the top it says excerpted from Morro Bay Municipal Code Chapter 15. At the bottom of that page is 15.04.120 PIER. So do any board members have suggestions or issues with any of the definitions on that page? Yes, Lynn.
Mooring or is not mooring.
So I guess the first part of your question, the definition of mooring, I'm of the mindset that mooring means the ball that you're floating out on, like for yourself, you know, out offshore. It's not
right.
A pier. It's not a slip.
I agree with you.
The way I look at this mooring definition, it could potentially include somebody tied to a slip.
Yes.
Because it says any appliance in the city of Morro Bay, other than to a pier, which is not carried on board such a vessel, which I would think would be anchor, would be your anchor.
Yes.
If you're anchored, you're not moored, you're anchored. So it's excluding anchoring, and they're excluding tying to a pier. But what about tied to a slip?
Doesn't 15.04.120, the definition of pier, take care of that question?
It defines pier as being fixed or floating structure, wharf, dock, float, or other landing facility. I would think that pier, I mean, you're right, but again, the definition of mooring does not exclude tying up to a slip, although pier includes tying up to a slip, so there's some sort of a funny conflict there.
I might be able to, I think there's two words, one's a noun and one's a verb, and a mooring is a ball with a chain going down to a block, and to moor, verb, is to tie to something, and the definition is for the noun.
Correct. I think the mooring definition here is for the noun. You're right.
Right.
Because it says it means any appliance, and an appliance is a noun.
Right. And it sounds like the issue Lynn was bringing up is that later in the document, it's being used as a verb, and that might be confusing. So we may need to.
Could you just put something in parentheses, tie up,
right.
Something like that?
Right. We may need to indicate somehow that it's a process of mooring, not the mooring appliance itself.
And in fact, there are people who use the term mooring to include being tied to a dock, a wharf, a pier, or any other structure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's just a matter of clarification on those terms.
Excellent.
If I can go on to the second one.
Yes.
And that's motorboat. It's the following one.
Mm-hmm.
Motorboat means any vessel propelled by machinery, whether or not such machinery is the principal source of propulsion, but shall not include a vessel which has a valid marine document issued by the appropriate federal agency. And to me, whether or not you are documented or registered or neither has nothing to do with what kind of boat you are, if you are a motorboat, a sailboat, or any other kind of boat.
That is a very curious definition, isn't it?
It is.
Because later
it's
on,
totally inaccurate.
Later on in 15.04.140, you have vessel.
Yes.
Every description of watercraft designed and principally intended for use, blah, 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 blah. I mean, that includes motorboats, sailboats, commercial fishing boats.
Right, anyway, and a vessel is any one of those.
Why did the city choose to define motorboat specifically? I mean, you can almost strike that. Why does it need to be there unless it's referenced somewhere else? So,
I mean, a motorboat is a vessel that is operated or navigates. Its propulsion is a motor.
Yeah, it could be
of any
it
kind.
It could be a 60-foot yacht that it is federally documented.
It could be my 8-foot skiff with its motor.
Yeah.
But the fact that it brings up whether or not you are documented, registered, or neither is irrelevant.
It's irrelevant and odd. I agree.
And so I would like to see that from the comma on, that clause struck.
Okay.
And I think almost any sailboat owner would object to being called a motorboat.
Well, in fact, I have a motor, so there are times when I operate it with a motor, and I must follow the rules of motorboats.
But that doesn't pin you to being a motorboat.
No, it does not.
Right. So shall we, for process-wise, shall we by consensus agree on element by element and then at the end, if so needed, make a motion?
As far as the areas that require attention?
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point, I don't think we need a motion. I mean, okay. we're just suggesting the
Not
areas.
Not individually, I don't think, no.
Yeah, no, I don't, yeah.
Okay.
I don't even think at the end, because we're suggesting these areas to you. This is almost like a workshop. And then on the final document, down the road, then I think we could approve a motion.
I thought we had it listed the other way.
All right. Anything else from board members on page one?
I just thought both of those definitions seem to defy logic, you know. I think change them, you know, get rid of the motorboat thing if you can, unless it's referenced somewhere else. And that mooring one is so obscure. Why do they go through all that agony of explaining that it can't be taken on the boat? I mean, it's a block on the bottom, you know.
Yeah, we could certainly really define what a mooring is, which is, you know, a block and chain that's fixed that doesn't move, you know, for permanent tie up of a boat or something.
And that's where the excerpt from the Santa Barbara Muni Code defines mooring as an anchor, chain, buoy, pendant, snubber, chafing gear, and associated equipment not typically stowed or carried aboard a vessel when underway, used to engage the seafloor, and through its resistance to drag, maintain a vessel within a given radius.
That's
to drag.
Wow.
That's torturous.
That's the opposite. That's the opposite of what we're looking
from
for.
From the frying pan into the fire on that one.
Snubber.
Okay. So we've identified an area there for you, Eric. Anything else on this particular page, board members? No?
I have one more.
Yep.
Pier. Pier means any fixed or floating structure for securing vessels. In normal language, a pier has a relatively specific meaning as this thing that sticks out into the water and is held to the ground with pilings. And this says a pier can also be, or includes, to quote, a wharf, dock, float, or any other landing facility. And I don't really have a problem with expanding the definition other than the fact that it certainly deviates, I think, quite far from standard language.
Lynn, in the California Boating Guidelines, State of California, their definition of a pier is pretty much with what you see right there.
I stand corrected, and I withdraw my criticism.
Well, no, you don't have to stand corrected at all. I think what it's all about, having participated in a harbor wordsmithing activity once before in my life, the ordinances, in order to keep the ordinances as brief, with as much brevity as possible, there's a search for a particular word that applies to a variety of uses, a variety of objects, and in this particular case, State of California and the city of Morro Bay chose pier. But the ordinances become quite burdensome if we start listing out all these other things. So if you have another word.
I've actually tried to think of another word or choose one, and none of them are really inclusive of all of those structures. So I can appreciate the intent of expanding the definition of peer to include those structures and keep it brief.
I agree with Lynn. I don't like it at all. A peer doesn't go up and down, and a float does. And to put them together for convenience of it seems like sooner or later you're going to run into, you know, you're like floats are in hazard of floating off the piles, but a pier isn't going to have that happen to it. It just seems defies logic again.
Yeah, I think I get Ron's point on this. So under this definition, the floating dock out in the middle of the bay there is a pier.
Yeah.
But this definition precludes what Ron is telling us is, I think, is that this definition precludes us having to define that floating dock. In other words, this is more of an umbrella definition. Is that the point that you were getting at?
It is the point, which isn't to say that there isn't a better word.
Right. Okay.
And then would it warrant breaking it up into two? Pier to me is pilings, fixed, platform above, doesn't float up and down. Going to Santa Barbara on theirs, in berth, they have a water area delineated by either floating or fixed dock structures intended for purpose of embarking, disembarking, and the wet storage of boats. A berth is also known as a quote-unquote slip. That kind of covers slips and boats. So I guess my question, and Gene may be getting to this, in your codes and as you do your waterfront architecture kind of stuff, will that run afoul of permitting type things as you move in with definitions?
Oh, I think that we can be more concise. We could say a pier is a fixed structure.
Broke it all out. They did pier, dock, float.
City pier.
You're right, they berth.
Yeah, and berth.
Yep.
So
yeah,
they broke everything out. I don't know whether we need to or not, but
one other point is not only is the pier not going up and down, but also the tie-up arrangements to the pier are not assigned, and the tie-up arrangements to all of the other things, they're assigned berths. So it kind of begs to make a distinction, I think.
Okay. So we've identified an area there. Yes?
Mr. Chairman, one of the challenges with this exercise, which is a good thing to do and quite necessary and a good use of everybody's time, one of the challenges is that it's we're working a bit in a vacuum because we don't have the body of the ordinances to reflect on to what the city is trying to accomplish with a particular ordinance or a group of ordinances.
Yeah, and I agree. So in this process, we're short of doing a complete workshop and having the ordinances stacked up in front of us and spending the 6 hours to take on the three or four pages. So, granted, I think the process lacks that, but for the sake of progress, I think this will work. And when we get Eric, the Harbor Department will do more of that work. My perception is that they'll do more of that work on their own and then bring that back to us.
Well, I wasn't suggesting we shouldn't do this. I was just saying that there's going to be another round that needs to apply to whatever our thought process is to the actual body of the ordinances themselves.
Yeah, good point.
So
taken.
Could we say on this peer definition, would it be safe to say that there's some concern on either ambiguity or what really applies to what. Do we want to have pier-like things defined as one and slips, the traditional thing we think of floating docks, separate and not included in that pier category, and then leave it to me to come up and figure out through the rest of the body of all that why maybe pier was defined that way and crafted that way.
Well, and I would think that part of the answer to that lies in if there are references further in the document or ordinance that refer to pier or wharf, dock, float, landing facility. If there are other references, then we probably need to be more specific. If there aren't, then that would suffice. Gene?
I was just going to suggest maybe a pier would include wharfs, pier heads, and there would be a fixed structure not subject to title action.
Yeah, I agree
with Gene. And then if necessary, introduce a second, an additional definition, which would be fill in the blank, berth, slip, whatever, which is a floating, moving object. And
that's what I was trying to say earlier, but I didn't say it as good as Gene.
Interestingly enough, within these definitions, because we do have on that first page pier, and included in that is wharf, dock, float. Further on in the document, in the rules and regs, we refer to the, is it head
head float berth, probably.
I'm going through the same thing that you went through, Lynn. I know it was forward, but I didn't mark it.
It's probably in our rules and regulations document.
Yep.
I saw you say head, and the head float berth head, we have.
That's what it was, head float berth.
Yeah, that's.
So we're using that, but we didn't really define it. So I think that should be defined in definitions on this first page. Anything else on this first page?
Jeff?
Yes.
I don't want to belabor this, but I'm looking at, again at pier and saying, all right, maybe we shouldn't be looking at the word pier and trying to define it, but seeing what it means, they're talking about fixed or floating structures for securing vessels. Which of those words best and most broadly names fixed and floating structures for securing vessels, and then choose the word that is most inclusive. To me, pier is not that word. A dock or a wharf, a dock is probably more inclusive or a broader word than pier. But just to attack it or think about it in a slightly different way, start with the...
Briefly discussed once before, there are a plethora of different kinds of commercial vessels, working vessels that don't catch fish. Not to denigrate a fishing vessel, because it's certainly an important commercial vessel, but there's all sorts of things. It even could apply to, I would defer to Eric on this, it could even apply to a pleasure vessel that's chartered to do a commercial activity. So I would encourage a modification, a broadening of the definition of vessels of commercial nature.
Thank you, Ron. And then as an aside, the Department of Fish and Game, they changed their name, so I'm sure you would have caught that one.
Yes,
yes, Alan.
Well, if we were to broaden that, would that mean that the commercial fishing, the commercial slips would now be up for rent by
Shibley?
Yeah, I think the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization would have to stand against that.
Well, there's an opportunity. I understand your point, and it's well taken. So then the city would need to follow. If in fact the wording of the existing ordinances drives the consideration of expanding the definition, then the city would need to make sure that insofar as it relates to those moorings or some number of moorings, that they are relegated to the commercial fishermen. And I understand that there's a very limited number of mooring opportunities in Morro Bay and that the fishing fleet occupies the vast majority of those. I'm not sure that it's in the city's best interest, however, to blanket define a vessel of commercial nature as only a fishing vessel.
So what about this? What about further defining? So we could broaden the definition of a commercial vessel while at the same time denoting commercial fishing, so that category would maintain its status, so to speak, and it wouldn't lose its narrowness of definition. Eric?
Yeah, so I was thumbing through, and Ron, your point you made earlier, and that's why I brought the book, because different things allude to different sections, and why a definition is here may be maybe made clearer when you go thumb through, page 427 and find it. I knew that we had something in here. So, as you know, our slips and piers are primarily intended for boats of a commercial nature. Our slips are only for commercial fishing boats on a permanent basis. Section 15.32.010 policy, the overriding title of that chapter is called Dockage, which is basically who we rent to. It is the policy of the city to rent or lease all city facilities at docks, wharves, and piers, there's our three words, primarily to those vessels of a commercial nature, i.e. commercial fishing boats, commercial abalone boats, etc. Rules and regulations governing the use of such docks shall be established by city council. So the intent was clear that fishing was the commercial nature that they wished to give the priority to.
Well, there strikes me that there's a little bit of ambiguity and probably purposeful ambiguity written into that. The word principally, which provides an opportunity, I think, for the city, if it so desires, to rent for some period of time, however short or however long, a particular slip to a commercial vessel other than a fishing vessel.
Which we do under a sublease and on the piers.
I understand.
You're probably right.
I understand that. Right. So the word principally, I think, is a good thing.
Yes.
And then the et cetera provides an opportunity for a commercial vessel to be defined as something other than strictly a commercial fishing vessel. So I've read that myself. I actually think it's pretty well crafted.
The primary or principally becomes the historic interpretation of that has been on a permanent basis. We'll rent to a commercial fisherman on a permanent basis. Well, when he's gone, we'll sublease and doesn't have to be commercial. That's where the wiggle room is to allow for the non-commercials.
That's not how I appreciate that, and I could easily be wrong, but that's not how I interpret that particular ordinance. I think if I had, hypothetically, if I had a research vessel, I think I could solicit the city for a permanent slip on the basis of that ordinance. So if, in fact, the city wants to restrict the use of city slips only to commercial fishing vessels, then that ordinance, I don't think, is correctly written.
But then you go to the definition that we started with, 1504.150, vessels of a commercial nature, strictly defines it to those that have fish tickets, which means
a commercial boat or a diving boat. Those are commercial vessels. There's no question about it. And it wouldn't be one under this definition. And to Alan's point, I think we're all aware of this and we agree. It's important that we maintain a distinction for commercial fishing vessels. That distinction isn't lost along the way. How does that sound to you, Alan?
Is your mic on? I had another question. What is Measure D? How does the language in that does it say vessels of a commercial nature, or does Measure D specifically?
Measure D also states primarily. Uses primarily commercial and recreational fishing. It doesn't say exclusive, it says primarily too.
Yeah.
Well, it's a difficult nut. I have to give you that because we have a scarce resource, and I think originally the fishermen were given the leg up on that to make it easier for the commercial fishermen. And it only seems like over time it's gotten harder for us, to make ends meet, some of us like myself. But, there is a bone of contention there, I mean, there's opportunities being lost by other types of businesses. Have to discuss that. It's a bigger question, policy question.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Lynn?
But does clarifying the use of language is not going to affect the way, if we apply the language consistently, it will not change any of the ordinances nor affect the way that commercial fishing vessels are dealt with. You would change the language in order to make sure that the intent of those clauses remains consistent at the same time that you're clarifying the language.
Correct. Gene.
Is the intent of the definitions to assure that the commercial fishing industry is going to get a slip, or are we just trying to clarify the definitions? If we're trying to just clarify definitions, then it sounds to me like we have two distinctly different types of commercial boats, fishing and whatever. And so we just need to create another a category.
I mean, I would purport by past practice policy, these two sections of the municipal code, that the city's intent for its slips, our 50-odd slips, our two piers, that the intention was that those would be primarily for commercial fishing boats, not commercial salvage boats, not commercial research boats, commercial fishing boats, primarily for. And implementation of that policy over the years has been, at least for the slips, permanent use is exclusively for commercial fishing boats. And the primarily part comes into play when Alan and others are out, we rent it out to non-commercial boats if we've got the space and we've got people on the list that want to get on. So that's where the primarily two gets interpreted. That's how we've historically looked at it. Whether we need to change anything in these two documents to tighten that up, loosen that up, make it more clear, I guess, is the question here tonight. And that
speaks to Ron's point earlier. We're operating in somewhat of a vacuum with this because we're looking at this definition now, not knowing exactly every place that this definition is applied down the road in other documents or the ordinance. But I'd like to get the rest of the board's response on this. I'm fine with expanding this definition with the understanding that further on, that commercial fishing vessels then is the use of the language for fishing vessels is clearly defined further on in the document as well. Does that make sense? Did I say that right? Yep. Okay.
Then we change the regulations for the slips exclusively for commercial fishing.
Now we're getting into policy, which is beyond the scope not only of this activity, but perhaps with the exception on an advisory basis of this body. I mean, right now we're working on definitions. So, I mean, I like the idea, other folks' idea of coming up with a bifurcated definition of commercial vessel, one which is a commercial fishing vessel, the other one which is other purposes, if you will. But the other thing, that's a policy determination. I mean, I think this is just a personal opinion. I mean, I think the historic intent that you've talked about, just this is a segue, and it really isn't on our agenda tonight, but
why they chose vessels of a commercial nature and then went on to define it, why they didn't just say commercial fishing vessels. And it shall be the policy of the city of Morro Bay to lease piers, wharves, and docks primarily to commercial fishing vessels. I don't know why they didn't just come out and say that to begin with, because then they go to define it to try and narrow down the definition on that. So I guess my takeaway is see about some cleanup language that could, although commercial vessels, other commercial vessels, there's certainly nothing wrong with those, and we don't want to say they're not welcome, but we want to make sure they don't get lumped in with commercial fishing, and that there is language, the way the language is written, that possibility is there. It's challengeable.
I think okay. What you just said, Eric, from my perception, recognizes the will of the body, and I see all the heads nodding up and down.
Yeah.
So, yep. Good. Lynn, another comment?
On the same thing, but off the topic of the commercial fishing, it says a commercial vessel of a commercial nature is one that has current commercial fishing license whose owner or operator holds a current commercial fishing license, which within the current calendar year has been actively used. And I would wonder if you really want to say within the current calendar year, because on January 5th, if it hasn't been used, then he's no longer a commercial fishing vessel, because it hasn't been used within the current calendar year from January 1, unless...
Yeah, I mean, you could make that argument, certainly, that on January 5th, the current calendar year is 5 days long.
Right.
And if Alan hasn't caught in his requisite thousands of pounds of fish to make up the dollar figure, he's not within... I mean, you could, sure, you can make that argument. I can see that in that language.
Easy fix.
Just put in
during the 12 months of a given calendar
right.
year.
Yeah.
One other thing that...
Go ahead, Alan.
Protocol there, but the state doesn't issue commercial fishing vessels licenses. It issues them registrations. So you should, in the first part of that sentence, you should say registration instead of license.
The vessel
has been issued a current commercial fishing license. Right. The vessel doesn't get a license. The vessel gets a
registration.
Commercial fishing registration.
Very good.
But also, if they can very often retain their slip, the commercial fisherman can retain his slip, even though he has not fished within 12 months, but he cannot go more than 24 months, if my memory serves me right. You don't kick him out of the slip after 12 months of not fishing, but he will have to relinquish his slip after 24 months unless he gets...
What does that have to do?
Sort of. So at the bottom of that section, the 1504-150, vessel of commercial nature, resolution 9085, which is now been amended to a different resolution, or will be if this is adopted to Tuesday night. Basically, that resolution allows for two waivers in any 10-year period. That's a guy can not fish for up to 24 months. They can be two 12-month periods concurrent. They can be 5 years apart, whatever. Within 10 years, they're allowed those two waivers. And then that resolution also stipulates if the fisherman can't make the minimum thousands of dollars per net ton currently, changing here shortly to a little different scheme, they have to show proof of 90 days fishing activity, which can be evidence with landing receipts, fuel receipts, a different number of things. So, yes, they are allowed a couple of years in there where they don't have to qualify with landing receipts.
I guess my question is it really pertinent that those limitations be included in the definition?
Well, and it seems that the way this is written, they're including those because of the narrow definition of that particular item. Obviously, when they wrote this definition, a vessel of a commercial nature, they were only referring to fishing, commercial fishing vessels.
If we want to talk about commercial fishing vessels, these other items are in different parts of the code.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they are... explained in different parts of the code. Those limitations are written into the code, but you don't really...
Days or nights, doing the usual and customary thing, so...
Per week.
Per week, yeah. It wasn't per month. There was an X number of days per month. It's in any... Oh, it's basically any seven-day period.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. All right, so then we are done with that page. So let's move on to the next page, which continues the definition of a liveaboard individual and or vessel and ends at the bottom with excerpted from Morro Bay Harbor Department rules and regulations. So anything on this page that needs attention?
Interestingly enough, D and E both address mooring again in the liveaboard ordinance.
Yes, Lynn.
Number two, a liveaboard vessel is any vessel which is moored. I'll accept. That's okay. We've already
There's
talked about
verb.
It. In Morro Bay Harbor for more than 60 days in any 12-month period and is occupied. It does refer to mooring. If a mooring is really one surrounded by water, then if you are living on a boat in a marina, you are not a liveaboard, thus not subject to the liveaboard requirements. In fact, most of our liveaboards, well, no, I can't say that, can I?
I agree with Lynn, and I would suggest changing that to a moored or berthed.
Or simply berthed.
Unless I missed something from you,
isn't
down in E, the shoreside mooring, doesn't that address that issue that you brought up?
What brings back the term mooring again, back to what we were speaking of earlier.
Is an offshore mooring, the other is a shoreside mooring.
The liveaboard ordinance chose, when they crafted it, they saw a reason to offshore mooring, shoreside mooring, basically whether you're on a mooring floating on a ball or whether you're tied up to everything else on shore, we're going to cover it. Basically, I think Ron's point of any vessel which is moored in Morro Bay, that word could be changed to berthed, docked, tied up, something much more general and better than moored, because it ties up that mooring thing again,
right.
Which is
so
noun
just
versus
so if
verb.
You say berth,
it's a noun versus verb thing again.
Yeah, well, that's a bit moored.
Well, no.
Moored is a verb.
To moor or a mooring. You have a verb and a noun form for each of those words.
Well, there's one interesting point. My accountant makes me list my slip fees as moorage, which is a noun, but it's
I hate to go backwards, but
I think my point on this is more cleanup language for this definition: mooring versus moored, tied up, secured, berthed, whatever. Come up with a good catch-all for.
I personally don't see a problem with the verb form of moored as it relates to item number two. I don't see a problem with it. It's quite a general concept, unlike the struggles that we quite correctly had with the noun version.
So, do we want to recommend to Eric that we include in the definitions the verb definition of moored, of mooring? Because, and this is what I was going to get at when I said I hate to go backwards, but if we throw in the word berthed or berthed, I don't see a definition for berth, whereas in the Santa Barbara one, they have a definition. And this is where when we start.
So I guess what you're asking, do we want a definition of mooring, the noun, and definition of moored, the berth,
right, to moor, right.
The verb,
right.
That has tied up, docked, whatever, that's so the catch-all for everything else.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's
that's the cleanest way.
I think that would be a good
so far.
A good fix.
Well, a berth is either surrounded by water or tied to something fixed.
Right, but that's from the Santa Barbara code. That's not from
that's
ours.
Yeah, but that's my what I'm. Yeah. That's my thinking on.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay.
So
I think I've got some good input and direction on that.
Good. We are continuing on the page. It's actually page 13 in our packet, but at the bottom of this page it says excerpted from Morro Bay Harbor Department rules and regs, and the bottom category is seaworthy. So anything else on that particular page that I just referenced? I know there was discussion we had before on the board about operable and seaworthy. Oh, I've got one above that, sewage. Means that portion, and this is F, sewage means that portion of the wastewater from toilets or any other receptacles containing human vessels that have sewage treatment plants on board and will dump effluent over the side. Do we want to address that?
So here's
state water?
There's a lot in this. I'm glad you brought this up because there's a lot of nuances to this one that's going to take, and I don't think we'll come to a conclusion here tonight, or we might get some direction where to go. There are a number of marine sanitation devices that treat sewage for discharge and are legal within state waters to discharge, unless you are a no-discharge zone as designated by the state, which we're not. Morro Bay is not one of the 17 or whatever no-discharge zones. So there are devices that do legally discharge. It is this Regional Water Quality Control Board staff's opinion, I've had these discussions with them, that basically those types of devices are little sewer treatment plants and subject to their permitting and testing and ongoing regulation. There's a whole other body of language in state law and Harbors and Navigation Code that tells what a local entity can and can't do with regard to marine sanitation devices, and there's a clause in there that I wish I brought it with me, but I didn't. That's where more research is going to need to be done. There's sections in Harbors and Nav Code that says that local entities cannot enact regulations with regard to marine sanitation devices, and my understanding of that is we can't enact codes dictating types of sanitation devices to be used, and it doesn't restrict us from addressing discharge from those devices. So this is where there's a lot of nuances going on in terms of those devices. And I think, and then we've got Ender Harbor Sanitation in 15.24, and again, back to your point, Ron, we need the whole body of work here. There's a section in 15.24, refuse discharge prohibited. It basically says you can't throw discharge, leave, cause, suffer, or permit to be thrown, you know, just about anything overboard. Trash, animal excreta, dead animals, whatever. I would purport to say that that means, and it goes on that gray water is okay, but black water falls in that, and treated effluent from these type devices would fall under this kind of catch-all that you can't throw anything else in the water. So this may be at odds with that state law. I don't know. That's something that I need to do a lot more research on in terms of these MSDs and their discharge. But it's a great point in that these devices that do treat and do are allowable under state law to discharge in state waters, we may or may not be able to further regulate, where in most cases, local law can always be more restrictive than state law. In the marine sanitation device world, state law has some exclusions to that that I'm, without getting an attorney in front of it, I'm not sure we can go there with this.
Right.
So it's something that takes more, but it's a good point of something to be addressed.
Ron?
The wording of item I, definition I, a, quote, adequate vessel sanitation facility, end quote, means an operational marine sanitation device or portable toilet approved by the United States Coast Guard as suitable to prevent direct discharge. I think that pretty well takes care of us.
Yeah, that doesn't say treated or untreated.
It just says
if it's treated per one of these devices,
prevent
I would
direct
read that,
discharge.
That's direct discharge.
Right.
Okay. I have a question,
Alan.
Yeah, if you'll all bear with me, I would really like to know more about what gray water is and what gray water can have in it. Do you know anything about that, Eric?
Gray water is basically sink water.
Which has soap
or
in it?
Shower water or bilge water.
Okay.
Does that include laundry wastewater?
Good question.
I think so.
If it's sink, you wash your dishes, you wash your clothes.
If it's sourced from a vessel, perhaps.
From a vessel.
bleach.
Good question. Gray water.
And specifically for a brine fishing boat, how about the brine that has fish blood in it at the end of a brine trip, which
squid boats, per I think state law, they can't discharge their squid water, and it's got to stay on land and through the pumping system and goes back into the boat and goes back out, as you know. Those other systems, don't know. So, do we want to think about maybe the definition of gray water?
Well, I'm comfortable with having it just black water and leaving gray water alone, but
leave gray water
it may
out of
come
it.
Up. I'm afraid it will come up.
Yeah,
Eventually it will, but we don't have to rush.
Yeah, let's put that in the delay as long as possible category.
Okay. All right. Anything?
Seaworthy as it's defined right now just means exactly what it says and no more. However, there is other language in various and sundry places in the city ordinances which require a vessel to be able to get underway and such and so forth. So I'm a little concerned that the definition of seaworthy doesn't include any motivation.
This is only in reference to the liveaboard?
No.
This is any boat within the harbor.
Because we have barges and with cranes on them, and they don't have any motive.
You're absolutely correct.
And they're seaworthy.
That's true. So that's an excellent point. So a marine structure, as a marine surveyor, I don't call those vessels. We call them structures. It doesn't mean that there aren't vessels. I'm just telling you, I don't call them vessels, nor do I don't think my brethren call them vessels. I mean, vessel implies that the thing, you know, has some sort of motive power. But in any case, that's an excellent point. So the definition of seaworthy should be expanded to include things that float that can't get under their own way.
Would it make more sense to define unseaworthy?
Well, and I'm wondering too if we just do away with the seaworthy and focus on operable condition.
Got a guy speak. Mm-hmm. When I read this thing and I saw the thing about a mass in there, I realized that they're trying to accomplish something. And, you know, a mass falling down and hitting somebody and killing them is just as bad as a lot of other things. And the whole idea of having the thing being sound, you know, and so I kind of liked it when I read that and realized that it was what the intent was.
And the unseaworthy or seaworthy is a concept that every harbor's been struggling with for decades because it's not a easily defined thing. I know the Harbor Masters Association grappled with it for years and years and years with the Department of Boating and Waterways. We were trying to get the state to adopt some sort of an unseaworthy definition, primarily trying to deal with derelict boats and termination of voyages, and they finally did a few years ago. They basically, as a Harbor Patrol officer, there's six or seven things in the Harbors and Navigation Code that if somebody's underway that we as a boating safety officer deem as unsafe, we can terminate their voyage. You don't have life jackets, leaking fuel, a number of other things. One of the things that was added to the list was the vessel is unseaworthy, and that defined unseaworthy as needing excessive, you know, pumping to stay afloat and a few other things. But that was strictly for termination of voyage to get an unsafe boat off the water while it's underway. It wasn't a generic definition of unseaworthy to be kind of used in a more broad sense, but it did take a shot at making a definition.
Well, and I noticed that the Santa Barbara definitions focus more on operability and then unseaworthiness as opposed to seaworthiness. I'll go Lynn first and then you, Ron. Lynn?
If we use both of these terms together in almost every instance, haven't we sort of solved the problem? Operable means that boat will move from point A to point B in its normal manner of operation, and if that happens to be with a towboat or whether it's towed or however, then that sort of covers the problem, does it not?
Can I make a point? Mm-hmm. Was part of the intent of the thing was for liveaboards not to have houseboats that didn't have their own propulsion? Were they trying to avoid having liveaboard barges?
Well, no. There's actually that's specifically addressed.
No, the operable and seaworthy wasn't liveaboard centric. There's the liveaboard ordinance itself spells out that barges and houseboats and other things can't be used for liveaboard purposes.
Yeah, so that's specifically addressed, Alan. Ron?
Eric, is there a compelling reason relative to rules and regulations and Morro Bay harbor rules and regulations and applicable city ordinances? Is there a compelling reason that there needs to be the use of the word seaworthy and therefore a definition for it, as opposed to getting there some, as Lynn suggested, getting there some other way?
Well, seaworthy versus unseaworthy, which to, protect our liability amongst other things and keep, and I think of mainly the North Teeper for a long time was, full of a lot of just junk boats that we've slowly but surely gotten rid of. The idea being that somebody wants to come in into the harbor and tie up at the pier, go on the anchorage, and they had a boat that was clearly not operable, seaworthy, or in very good shape, and it was a threat amongst in various and sundry ways, for us to be able to say, no, you cannot use our pier.
Do you think that there is some reason to have the concept of seaworthiness and the concept of operability as two separate concepts as it relates to the rules and regulations of the ordinances? Or can they be folded, as suggested, in some way, shape, or form into a single?
You could probably fold them together or keep them separate. I mean, Santa Barbara chose to just do operable. One thing we are missing from our operable, whether we elect to try and suggest combining or keeping together, one thing we are missing from operable is means of safely maneuvering under a vessel's own power. I mean, I can take a 60-foot boat with a 2-horsepower motor and make it move. Is that operable? Well, probably not. So I think safely maneuvering needs to be added. Combine them or keep them apart? I mean, my thoughts are, rather than trying to define what seaworthy is, define unseaworthy and give the discretion to the patrol officer making that determination, the harbor director making that determination based on some pretty basic facts, and whether that's the stuff Ron's talking about, the keel mast, whatever, the thing is in such a state that, it's not safely capable of doing this, that, or the other thing. That would be my druthers.
Jeff?
Yes, Gene.
Eric, are we just talking about rules and regulations for city facilities only? Because you kept mentioning city facilities, but there's more than that.
No, not strictly for city facilities. These rules and regulations apply to the whole bay. As does the municipal code. Obviously, when it comes to our slips, and our vessels of a commercial nature, that's our slips. That's because those are city-operated facilities, as per the definition. When it comes to, say, Marina Square, no, our commercial slip rules wouldn't apply there, but all our other general stuff, whether it's the liveaboard or the overboard discharge of sewage or oil discharge or vessel sanitation, that all applies, including this operable seaworthy.
Yeah, but you were mentioning city facilities. So I want to make sure we're talking about the whole bay.
Bill?
If you look at Santa Barbara's definitions here, they have number K, vessels in the harbor must be operable. And they've actually outlined it fairly quite a bit. And I don't know. I like it. I like what they said here. I mean, especially if you're saying if a boat comes in and wants to get a slip or tie up to the pier, if we had these things right here, that would be a very easy thing for you to say no.
Which one are you talking about in Santa Barbara's?
Vessels in the harbor must be operable.
Is
vessels
that
assigned
X?
To, you see that?
It's item K.
K?
K.
Well, it's a second K, I think.
Oh.
Is it double K?
Yeah, no.
No?
It's the K after the double K.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's three pages.
Yeah.
Three
oh,
pages,
gotcha. Okay.
Three pages.
They didn't do it
past
right.
The first K.
Gotcha.
Right. But you see how they did that there? I like some of the verbiage here.
Waterfront directed determines it's not operable.
And the one word addresses the concern that was expressed to you earlier. I could see how someone would express that concern if your engine was out for repair and you had an abusive harbor director, they could tell you to leave. But the one word here is may. The slip permit may be terminated. So that leaves a little bit of leeway so that the harbor director could, yes, see that the boat currently is inoperable, but if he or she knows that the engine is out being repaired, then they're not going to terminate the
And you could write some permit. Sort of an allowance for, normal and occasional repairs, at the discretion of kind of stuff if you really wanted to worry about that part.
Yeah, but, that's a task for the ordinance, not for a definition of words, because what we're looking at right now in the Santa Barbara thing is, in fact, the ordinance.
Yeah, that's not a definition anymore. They've got an operable definition, which gives a couple lines of safe and maneuver on its own power like ours, but then this is a whole other section that addresses ocean, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it's anything within city limits.
And does it call it the bay or the harbor?
Water of Morro Bay.
Thanks.
So, circling back to the operable and or versus seaworthy, I'd like it if we could give Eric our thoughts a little bit more concretely. If we want to, do we want to try and define seaworthy? Obviously, well, let's start with the easy one. Operable, I believe we would want to leave in. Is that correct?
Yes.
No, I see one sideways look over here, Ron.
Unless the language, the word operable is already embedded somewhere in a bunch of ordinances, and one or more ordinances, because changing them on a basis of nomenclature is arduous. So if it isn't, then I'd like to consider the possibility of folding them into the concept of either seaworthy or unseaworthy, either one. Unless you tell me, Eric, that there is some reason by virtue of the existing ordinance language, I don't see any reason to have both of them.
I'm not aware of the rest of the Muni Code or our rules and regulations of operability being endemic in lots of other places.
Isn't it the case that in the liveaboard ordinances that the concept of operability is important?
Yes.
As opposed to seaworthiness.
Correct. In the liveaboard ordinance itself, and I will get to it. It's not in the definitions. It's in the permit issuance section. Vessels used for liveaboard purposes must be in good material condition and not likely to sink or become a menace to navigation and to be of design suitable for operation on the waters of the Pacific Ocean. Currently registered or documented. It's somewhere else in here, and I will get to it if you bear with me. It says something about the boat getting underway under its own power.
Well, if we keep them both, then they have a tool to work with, so if they so choose. So, sure, both of them. Sure.
Well, so we were starting off with the operable.
And then Eric corrected. I mean, he's the one who wants to include the word safely, which is certainly wise, between of and maneuvering.
Right.
And then we all talked about... I'm driving toward a drive toward your point here.
Mm-hmm.
We all talked about what does berthing mean, so maybe we should throw out on the table the possibility of berthing or mooring location.
Mm-hmm. And so Ron's looking at the specific definition of operable with that one, Eric. And then what I'm going to get to in a moment after hearing what Lynn has to say is addressing the seaworthy. Do we want to keep that in, expand, or eliminate? So, Lynn.
Okay, looking at the very last page, and this is from Ron's quotes here. Fit for service or seaworthy vessels moored or berthed in the City of Morro Bay waters or waters controlled by the City of Morro Bay must at all times be completely without hazardous conditions, must be fit for the vessel's intended service, be ready for immediate cruising in local waters in safety, and with no significant probability of requiring assistance. Does that phrase there not define seaworthy?
Operability, I think.
With cruising in local waters in safety and with no significant probability of requiring assistance is not...
That's...
All right, my question to you then.
Sure.
Where did you get this? Did you write that? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I like that verbiage. Right
As an amalgamation, by the way. I mean,
right.
So,
I mean, of a prior review of many different
right.
ports and marinas.
And you have that under seaworthy, and I would say that the two parts of that sentence would come pretty close to defining seaworthy and operable.
I think you're right. It does appear to be an amalgamation. Rick Allegert, when we put in that operable and seaworthy, it wasn't to define a lack of a definition in the Muni Code anywhere else because it didn't exist anywhere in the Muni Code. Seaworthy, certainly not. I don't think it's written anywhere else in the Muni Code. But operable, other than the litter ordinance, which I'm still trying to find, that's about the only one that may have some reference in there. So, no, I don't think if we change operable, seaworthy, meld them together, whatever, I don't believe that it's going to affect major other sections in the municipal code that we need to go after. If it does, I mean, that's obviously things part of my homework if we go there, is to go look at those sections and make sure that the two match. That would be part of the overall.
So this is challenging because I'm listening and reading at the same time, but and maybe I've missed it, so that's why I throw out that disclaimer at first. Do we have a clear idea of... I've heard us say that we do want to leave operable in, but we're considering combining seaworthy and operable. Or do we want to do we want to eliminate seaworthy and use focus
Wands.
On unseaworthy?
No, use Wand's definition, fit for service.
So eliminate seaworthy and replace that with fit for service.
Oh,
is that our suggestion?
I would simply define seaworthy as fit for service.
Yeah.
With no significant probability of assistance.
So, and the reason that I'm focusing on this is because it's been brought up in public comment before, and I've heard from some other folks that one particular word, seaworthy, may have broader implications just in terms of insurance companies and legalities. So
yeah.
do we want to get rid of seaworthy altogether?
But if
altogether
we have a definition,
for,
then don't you not get rid of those problems? And I don't want to see it eliminated, in part thinking back over some of the comments from liveaboards and the reasons that they don't get their permits approved, and they start digging into the definitions. My boat is operable, and you don't think it's seaworthy, but I do. Well, seaworthy needs the definition.
Gene?
These are definitions for the City of Morro Bay.
Right.
Correct.
City of Morro Bay says seaworthiness is this.
Yeah.
Now, whether a state says something else or insurance company says something else, that's beside the point.
That's good.
We, City of Morro Bay, says this is what we consider seaworthy.
Okay. So what I'm hearing at this point, we've had two members just say that that they would prefer, if I'm hearing correctly, to maintain seaworthy
preference.
As a word and define it.
That's my preference.
Okay, so
well,
there's two
well,
folks on that side. What about on this side?
Just to restate another board member's idea, it's not my idea, you could take the existing definition excerpted from Morro Bay Harbor Department rules and regulations for seaworthy and add a second sentence from the fit-for-service notation in the notes and say that such vessel must at all times be completely without hazardous conditions, must be fit for a vessel's intended service, and be ready for immediate cruising in local waters and safety and with no significant probability of requiring assistance. I mean, I'm just sort of taking some license with what Lynn said, but that could be introduced as a second sentence, and where does that, what does that do for us?
And so including that in the definition of seaworthy as the second part of it. Okay. And again, so we don't necessarily need to wordsmith the entire definition tonight. What I do want to get, though, is our intent as a board, and I want to make sure that I do that accurately. So we want to maintain a definition for operable. We also want to maintain a definition for seaworthy.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's fine. And I still want to be cognizant of this concept of, you know, be ready for immediate cruising for the people working on their boats, because there are legitimate projects that need to get done, and there's got to be an allowance for that. And, you know, Santa Barbara's language has the language we spoke about earlier where we, it was Santa Barbara's, where May, mm-hmm. you know, approval of the waterfront director, I think
sure.
some kind of allowance in there at, sure. you know, at the water harbor director's discretion, may this. So that
yeah.
gives us the room that, okay, Fred, you know, you're, yeah, your engine's out for 3 months because you're getting a major refit. Fine. I mean, there's no harm, no foul.
Yeah, unless provided with dispensation by the city of Morro Bay Harbor mm-hmm. Department.
Point.
Yes, Alan?
I don't like the word immediate because in my own experience, my boat is never ready to leave the harbor until I make darn sure it is, you know. I mean, it's only at the last minute that it becomes ready to leave, so.
Could you live with timely?
Well, yeah.
But I think part of what we've gone through from what I've seen over the last 4 years with the public comment and what I've heard is, you know, there's this person's interpretation, and then there's the Harbor Department's interpretation. And when we say timely, that allows for that difference in interpretation, where if it's more strict in its language, it leaves less room for interpretation. And using a word like may still allows the harbor director to use some discretion. That's what I'm thinking. Yes, Alan.
Just on a general note, in my experience with the Morro Bay Harbor Patrol, I would like to see them left with as much discretion on almost everything, because there are many times when bending the rule is gets you a lot further along than of having some strict policy that they have to follow in spite of what they feel in their gut level how it ought to go. So.
A number can get troublesome if you put a 15-day, 30-day, 60-day, because invariably, like you said, I mean, okay, you pull the engine out to do the engine work, then you go put it in gear, now the transmission blows up, now you got to go fix this, and it just keeps becoming a sliding scale, and it's easier to use a little more nebulous language that, you know, provided, you know, at our discretion, there's progress being made. It's obviously the boat isn't just going into dereliction and being stripped, and it's going to fall apart 15 days, 30 days, whatever. You know, there's other signs, there's other things that can start falling apart if it's one of those boats that's going down the other path that you don't have to have a strict time limit on. I think we can still operate
right.
within that.
Well, and I go back to that word may. So may allows for that discretion, but I seem to be in the minority with that with that view, which is fine.
I think everything should say may. It should be at the harbor director's discretion. Every time I read something, I say, well, they ought to be able to bend that if they feel a need to, you know.
Well, and there,
just in general, I think.
And there is, in the Livid Board ordinance, there is a lot of discretion left to the harbor director.
Great.
And other parts of the ordinance as well. Okay, so to make sure I'm encapsulating this correctly as your chair, we are in, and correct me if I'm not, we are recommending that both, that there be definitions for both of those words, operable as well as seaworthy. All right.
Yes.
Okay. And I think we've given Eric a lot of good fodder
No, it's great. And it's an important one. It's a big, meaty one, and it's an important one. So.
Okay. And is there anything else, Eric, that you would ask of us with regard to either of those definitions before we move on?
No, that's the safely on the operable part was the only thing I saw missing. So, nope.
Okay, good. All right, that concludes that page. The next page, well, is excerpted from Santa Barbara Municipal Code, Chapter 17. Is there anything on that page? It starts at the top with 17.04.010 definitions, ends with L, harbor. Is there anything on that page that we maybe want to recommend that be included in our definitions?
And I would say this page, the rest of the pages are anything else. This isn't a do-all, be-all by any means.
Yes.
They've provided a pretty reasonable, I think, definition for birth. We were talking earlier about birth. I can't find any particular fault with their definition. So if we need a definition of birth, I might suggest to the board that they consider suggesting to the Harbor Department that they use that definition.
And they also, I was going to say slip the word in there, but that's probably not the right verb to use. They also put the word slip under the definition of birth also. They slip in a slip.
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah. Because that screws up the the entire first sentence. The first sentence, I think, is very good. A berth, a water surface area delineated by either floating or fixed dock structures, a pier, a wharf, a dock, etc., intended for the purposes of embarking, disembarking, and wet storage of boats. And then they say, also known as a slip. Well, a slip is a very specific thing.
Right.
Yeah, but we don't need, you're right, Lynn, that second sentence. The second sentence doesn't either. The reason it's in quotation.
It shouldn't be there.
The reason it's in quotation marks is because that's pulled from their own ordinance.
So for our purposes, we'd want to strike that second sentence.
Right. And maybe birth is the word
that is assigned to you, you know.
Oh, no, I don't have that definition.
You don't think that has that connotation?
Not personally.
I do. I think of it the same way you do, Alan.
Which that's where I'm birthed. That's where
I'm birthed.
Yeah. But I you know.
Ships lie at birth.
Yep.
Yeah, but the harbor.
They don't own them. They don't rent them. I mean, they do temporarily, but.
But harbor, like the Humboldt Bay Harbor District, will assign you a berth, you know, or you get a berthing assignment. And, I mean, I've just run into that. Eric, maybe you have some thoughts on that. I'm just wrestling with my own.
Yeah, slip, berth, tie-up spot, moorage, dockage, you know, they all can get used interchangeably depending on who you are and where you come from and what you're used to.
Okay. Yeah, it's a small point. It just bothers me, but it's okay. I can easily sleep with that P under the mattress.
So I think the point, I think we've recognized the point, and I'm sure Eric gets it as well. In our code, we've got pier in there, which has its own definition, which we shined a flashlight on. And so I think Eric's going to look at that relative to definitions of things like berth, dock, slip.
I'm good with berth as a substitute in that case for pier. Right. Yeah.
So we've done our job by identifying it. And not falling into the black hole of wordsmithing it at this point. Well, maybe we slipped a little into it, but we managed to stay out of it. Anything else on this particular page, ending with harbor, that we maybe want to suggest for our own? No. Okay,
I've got one.
Yes, Eric.
Dinghy.
Dinghy.
Currently in our, I think it's in our rules and regulations, not in the municipal code. It's so written that the head float space, basically, you know, and our slips that have our fishing boats, and Tideland's dock, and to an extent our little 3-hour docks, that space between the dock and shore is for tenders and skiffs and dinghies and those sorts of things, and we've never had a definition of said tenders, skiffs, and dinghies. Most people, it's a small rowboat, maybe something with a little motor, but on occasion, and it's fairly regular occasion, although it's not an epidemic of any sort, but we get people that push the limits on that, and they want to put something that's 14, 16 feet with a motor, and it's like, well, it's not really a skiff anymore. So I personally would like to see some sort of a definition. Santa Barbara takes a shot at it. We have nothing. They basically say it's a small boat uses a tender. Well, what's a small boat uses a tender?
Yeah. I mean, I think of the boat that I would like to have would have a 16-foot Boston Whaler tender.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, I'm not being facetious when I say that. Lynn?
We had the Russian boat that had a 40-foot tender.
Well, yeah, I was thinking of that,
too. That was very nice.
VA, yeah.
In the case that we're actually talking about, the problem with taking those 14, 16-foot boats is that it restricts the maneuverability of the boats on the inside, right, to get in and out.
And it takes up space for two or three others instead of one.
And I don't know if it would be applicable, but at the yacht club where we have the same kind of problem, we have 20 skiffs, tenders, or small boats tied there. We just put an absolute limit on their length and thus do not define the terms, because if you go longer than 10 feet, then the other skiffs cannot get around them. So that's it. Got a tape measure.
What are they bow only? Are they tied up just with the bow? So they hang full length?
Right.
Okay. So the head at the head floats, they tie up like parallel parking.
Right. The head floats. Okay.
Yeah, and then so I'm thinking, in your example, Lynn, and I agree with that example. However, that's one specific area.
So we're
familiar with, say, the mean tide to the distance from the mean tide from the shore to the dock at mean tide. Whereas this, we've got different areas. So maybe instead of an absolute length, maybe throwing something in, a definition for the size that would not inhibit maneuverability behind the or on that side of the docks.
At that head dock location.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Would that help, Eric?
Discretion of the harbor department.
Yeah.
Right. And and that leaves some discretion as well. Because, you know, maybe
where it crosses over at some point, you know, because we allow our head float berths is primarily for the mooring holders out there that can tie their boats up behind tidelands or some other locations. There's some other folks that rent our head float berths and physically rent the space, because the Oyster Barge folks are one down at the south end, and there's a couple other guys that have over the years rented at a more commensurate rate space behind the head floats to secure that spot, and as long as it doesn't impede everybody else, that's been fine. There's been enough space. Where it becomes an issue is if somebody, it's mainly from mooring folks that move in with a big old boat and start taking up a ton of space where, you know, because everybody tends to get their own space and wants to tie up at the same place every time, and then when somebody moves in with something big, it upsets the order of things. So I'm fine with leaving it, not coming up with a strict number definition, because in one location it may work, maybe an 8-footer that is about the limit of space that can fit in there, and another location it might be a 10-footer. But that answer your question?
Yes.
All right. Anything else on that particular page? I think, we were clear up here. Anything else, Eric, on that page before we move on?
No.
All right. So the next page starts up at the top with M, Harbor District, and at the bottom is V, Mooring Permit. And we're still on excerpts from the Santa Barbara Municipal Code, Chapter 17. Anything from those definitions that we want to suggest be included in ours? Nope. Okay. The next page At the top is mooring site, and at the bottom is waterfront. And I would point out, too, that the second definition down is operable. A vessel's ability to maneuver safely under its own power from any place in the harbor district to the open waters of the Pacific Ocean and back to its point of origin. So they use back to its point of origin. I believe in our definition we had back to its...
Berthing location.
Berthing location.
It was Alan's. So either we copied Santa Barbara or Santa Barbara copied ours. They look awfully similar.
They are very close. I noticed that, although I did like their point of origin as opposed to birthing location, because maybe we're starting from Tidelands and going to the harbor mouth and then going back to Tidelands dock, and that's not necessarily my birthing location, but that is my point of origin. Or maybe even I cruised over to the Harbor Patrol docks and then we did it from there. That would be my suggestion on that one.
Well, there is a difference, though, because they're talking about the open waters of the Pacific Ocean as opposed to our definition says as far as the harbor entrance.
Yeah, but I think Jeff's just talking about the point of origin portion.
But are you bringing up a separate point altogether, Alan?
Well, you were saying they look to be the same, but you were just talking about the point of origin? No.
The comments I was just making were referring only to the point of origin. I think as a separate issue, you're bringing up the fact that in Santa Barbara's definition, they talk about maneuvering safely under its own power from any place in the harbor district to the open waters of the Pacific Ocean. Basically, the way I'm interpreting that, that's saying the same thing as ours, because we're talking about harbor mouth, which is Estero Bay the open waters of the Pacific, or do you have to leave Estero Bay to get to the open waters?
Well, you don't actually have to leave the harbor entrance in our definition, but you just have to get to it.
And they're saying to the open waters, and so you basically you're touching the edge of it and then come back is the way I would look at that. Which to me basically means the same thing as going to the harbor mouth and coming back.
Well, we spent a lot of time in a prior meeting or meetings talking about, as it relates to the liveaboard ordinance, but it applies, I think, generally as to where the boat has to go to prove its operability. And I think we all concluded that we were fine with the or to an inspection site designated by the harbor director.
Right. Because the intent, right? I mean, the intent here is just to make sure that it's an operable boat, that it's not a derelict vessel sitting out there that can't go around. And
yeah, and not that it can go to Cambria and back in
right.
25 knots of wind. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, all right. And I'll start with you, Ron, on this one, because we get into the meat here of your excerpts, actually the conclusion of your excerpts as well. Anything there that you would want to bring to our attention?
Not as it relates to definitions. Okay. I think we've been there.
Okay. Good. And so that brings us to Exhibit A, which is the actual City of Morro Bay Harbor Department rules and regs for vessels using city piers, docks, and offshore moorings.
And the only definition in there was operable, the operable and seaworthy ones. There's no other definitions in there.
Right, so going back to our original discussion, or our discussion at the beginning of this topic, the definitions laying the groundwork then for these rules and regs. Because interestingly enough, at the top there, for vessels using city piers, docks, and offshore moorings, and that illustrates why those definitions before were so important. I did notice, and this is I think would fall under the definition heading, is item one, Eric, under the rules and regs, Morro Bay Harbor Department general regulations. The last sentence there, no person may live aboard a non-transient vessel in excess of 4 days without first obtaining a permit as provided for in Morro Bay Municipal Code, section 15.40. Do we want to just add live aboard before that word permit? Because it just says without first obtaining a permit. Because isn't it that referring to the live aboard permit?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yes, Lynn?
In excess of 4 days without any additional wording there is very harsh. That means if you come into this harbor and you stay for 1 week, you're supposed to go get a live aboard permit.
No, that's, well, a non-transient vessel.
As provided in Morro Bay Municipal Code 1540.
Yeah,
1540 is going to be the overriding regulation that's going to control it, which is the live aboard ordinance, which defines you've got that 60 days to where you can stay without a permit, four more days or nights doing the usual blah, blah, blah. That's going to be the overriding definition, not this little short one. I think the intent in here was to just put people on notice that, hey, if you're going to be in your boat, and it could use some cleanup. It's not a definition per se, so I don't want to go too deeply into this.
Right.
That sentence, and I've made note of it when we go through this whole process, can be cleaned up to match a little better.
Okay.
So,
one more point. It bothers me every time I read this. No person may live aboard. That's two words. Live aboard is not the same as a live aboard. To live aboard is to live aboard two words. So.
The English professor is coming out of me.
Well, it's just.
You're right.
I don't know. It's
two words.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
On to the next page at the top of the next page, where it says berthing space behind head floats on city slips will be designated as head float berth. So I think I mentioned that before. I just wanted to be sure we got that because we don't have a definition in our definition section at the beginning of what a head float is.
That'd probably be a good definition to add, add that language.
Are we just going through the rules here with regards to definitions?
Yeah, we're trying to stick just with the definitions at this point. So if you see something in here that refers to something that, like the head floats, where we don't have a definition of what a head float is, it would be appropriate to bring that up at this time. Did we see anything else on those first two pages of the rules and regs?
The waiting list procedures, second paragraph. Mm-hmm. Vessel and the vessel's owner must meet the definition for commercial fishing vessel. We don't really have a definition for commercial fishing vessel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you do.
So we need to make that jibe with the definition.
It's not specific.
Doesn't the new resolution, presuming it passes, doesn't the new resolution make that definition? So you could go as per resolution, blah, blah, blah.
I thought
commercial fishing vessel?
Changed the qualification part.
Okay.
So what I'm going to do here, and it's a valid point, Lynn, that this language should match whatever our definitions come out to be in the end.
Right.
However we view that bifurcation, this reference should match that so that you're not sent off in a direction that doesn't have anything.
So that's good. That validates what we caught earlier with the definition of commercial vessel. Good. Anything else on page 1 and 2 of the rules and regs? All right, we'll move on to page 3 and 4. We've got 8 pages of the rules and regs, so I'm going to take them 2 at a time.
Yeah, and I must admit that I did not read this part of the document looking for this particular thing. And I don't feel that I'm really prepared to read it right now and pick out anything that
I would consider a problem.
No, I'm with Lynn. I did not either. Maybe I should have, but I didn't.
Okay.
Right, I didn't think of it in that term.
Right, and our intent wasn't to pick over this, to start picking at the rules and regulations, is going at definitions. Rightly so, there's a couple of definitions that seem to be embedded in here.
Right.
Right, but I didn't read that
right.
with that in mind. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, yeah. So going through the process that we've completed tonight, then what I'd suggest is that everyone go through the rules and regs with a fresh eye, because this has been a very beneficial and illuminating process for us, and hopefully for Eric as well, or at least helpful for Eric. And when, as you read through these rules and regs, read through it with your definition lenses on, and see if there's anything in there that you feel needs a definition.
And other problems, I presume.
Well, not so much from a policy standpoint, because what we'll do is we take these phases. Eric will specifically look for policy changes, but I would like to first tackle it from the definition standpoint. And we may be able to do that the same night, the next phase. If we're looking at the rules and regs, we could start off by just finishing up the little definition part and then moving on. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, if there's any more hidden in there. There's not many. I mean, you just caught a couple.
Right. Okay.
There may be one or two others buried in there, but
I think it would be cursory. It would go quickly. Okay. Well, then that completes. Is there anything else anyone wants to throw in with regard to definitions? Because that is the last part of that before we conclude that agenda item. Wow, good job, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, that can be a slog, but it's something that needed to be done and has to be done, and we got at least that portion of it done. So everybody give yourselves a pat on the back. Well deserved. That concludes item C1, a review of Harbor Department rules and regs document and Morro Bay Muni Code Chapter 15 for input and direction on revising definitions. Very good. Item C2, an update from the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee on the committee's recent activities. Ron Reisner is our committee chair. Ron, any report?
Sure. The Ad Hoc Committee received from the city's liaison with the consultant relative to the market demand analysis for a harbor facility. The liaison is the harbor director. We received a draft of the final report that the consultant, Lisa Wise Consulting, proposed to publish. We were asked to review that. The Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization, who is a co-sponsor of that analysis, is conducting, I believe, its own review, and I'm sure the Harbor Department is doing its review. But insofar as the Ad Hoc Committee is concerned, we received that draft about 3 weeks ago now, I think. It circulated through the committee, and the committee provided its review comments back to the liaison, the harbor director. What the general impression that the committee had relative to the draft report focuses on the contract deliverables. There is a task in the contract, was in the proposal, and it's in the contract, that's called task number 6, and very briefly contains the following contract deliverable elements. Identify the most important services. Identify the potential demand. Identify the opportunities and constraints for marine facility operators. Make recommendations on the viability of a boatyard and haul-out facility in Morro Bay. Make recommendations to the city liaison,
okay,
which is the harbor director.
Right, okay.
Who has acknowledged the receipt of those comments.
Okay,
so good.
And where do you see the process going from here?
That's an excellent question, and I think I'll have to defer to the city liaison for any possible information that might be available to answer that to address that question, not to answer it, but to address it.
Thank you. So as Ron said, we got a draft report that had the case studies and the survey information collated and put into a document for our review, circulated to Ron and the committee. It went to the Fisherman's Organization as well. I got good input back from the committee, several committee members. Fisherman's Organization, I'm assuming, will provide their own input. We provide our input to Tom Hafer, just so he saw what we're providing. And I basically collated all of the committee members' input into a document of comments. Some of them, the comments matched, they're overlapping, so I didn't need to cut and paste every individual comment from every committee member and send it. I summarized them together and submitted that. I went through the document as well myself, track changes mode, and did a markup of the entire document. Submitted that to Lisa Wise Consulting, and I just sent that out on... took me a couple days to get through the document to really track change it up. I think I sent that out on Tuesday evening. So we're got an email back from Henry from Lisa Wise. He wants to meet next week and go over that. I'm hoping that the Fisherman's Organization has provided their comments through Tom. Alan?
Send what you sent to Henry? Did you send that to Tom?
Yes.
Oh, because so, I haven't seen it.
So Tom should have that. It was, I'm pretty sure, it might have been yesterday afternoon, but I'm pretty sure it was Tuesday afternoon. But yes, Tom's got my comments. He's got everything that I sent to Leastwise Consulting. So we're going to be meeting with the consultant next week to look at all those comments and see what next steps are. I think what was the main thing that I think everybody's identified as missing, or one of the main things we identified as missing, is trying to establish some degree of outside demand. We know there's a demand within Morro Bay. We know the fishermen, a certain amount of demand coming from fishermen and recreational boaters here in Morro Bay. But what's the outside demand, especially when we're talking about boat lift haul out size? If you're talking about getting to a larger size lift, there's not many boats that need much over a 60-ton lift here in Morro Bay, if any. And if we're trying to attract that kind of a customer, what is that customer size? And getting data on those customers, the survey as it was sent out didn't really get out and reach that far. It was focused more on Morro Bay specific. So we're going to talk next steps with the consultant, see where we go. The other thing that we were looking at in the report that we'd like to see a little more of is a sort of a quantified, a number. The boatyard, will expect to attract X number of boats over a year and potentially derive X amount of revenue if you look at other boatyard type revenues. So that we'll be meeting with a consultant next week and seeing what our next steps are to try and refine that and make that a little better. Next steps in terms of where we go from here kind of depends on the outcome of our meeting next week. At some point, we'll probably be circling back to the Harbor Advisory Board with that through the ad hoc committee. Then eventually getting to City Council to see if next steps are in order, which is further exploration of where and funding and entitlements and all that stuff. So we'll see where we go from there. Out of last month's meeting, Ron, I think, I'm not sure who made the comment, it might have been Bill. There was a grant opportunity identified by that consultant, possibly to apply for to continue funding this process. It was Coastal Commission Climate Ready Grant. I did look into that after that meeting, and I did apply for one of those grants. I ended up calling several folks in Coastal Commission, or Coastal Conservancy, not Coastal Commission, Coastal Conservancy. I did contact the Conservancy prior to submitting it. It didn't sound like our grant application would be very competitive, because what that grant really focuses on is climate change and how are you as a grantee proposing to help climate change and help the state's adaptation to climate change. And the main hook we had in that was reducing boat travel miles from Morro Bay folks not having to go up and down the coast to go to barrios, which is
Thank you, Eric. Any questions or comments for either Ron or Eric with regard to the Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee and the report and, and where we are in the process, Gene?
I'm kind of disappointed in the consultant's response. I think that's why we spent all of this money, for them to come up with some hard numbers, and it seems to me like they're just regurgitating a little bit of stuff we gave them and they're collecting a lot of money for it.
Thank you. Bill?
I agree with those sentiments. In your meeting with Henry next week, are you going to hopefully set a time frame for him to get back to us with maybe some better data? I mean, a tight time frame?
That question, actually, you were looking at me, Bill, but it should be directed at the liaison, who was the harbor director.
So, Eric, I mean, hold him to the fire?
Yeah, obviously time is of the essence. I think as originally proposed, it had mid to late November, maybe into December for the report deliverable, which we're at, you know, at least in terms of a draft. You know, there is getting the draft, you know, we asked for a pretty quick turnaround from the ad hoc committee. I spent, like, say, 2.5 solid days just putting my comments in, so knowing that there is some turnaround time for us to get information back to them, and then if we bring to the Harbor Advisory Board and or City Council for any kind of other input, that stuff takes time. But yes, absolutely, we want to keep this moving as much as we can. If for nothing else, you know, the grant that the Fishermen's Organization got, if they continue on with this from the Cable Committee, you know, that has some time constraints to it, I'm sure, as well. And from our standpoint, I mean, obviously we want to see it moving forward as well, because timing with everything else is, you know, right now for continuing on with this. So yeah, absolutely. I'm not, you know, if 6 months is the time frame to come back with a complete report, I don't think 6 months is going to work. It's going to need to be a little quicker than that.
Any other questions or comments with regard to this topic? Alan.
I hate to do this, but if they're going to go forward from this point, I'm just wondering, you know, are we going to then do a financial one step with a financial feasibility analysis? I had a conversation with Henry when this draft came back, and I was telling him, you know, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot. You know, I was expecting more, and he's pointed out to me that, well, you broke it, you separated those two things, the demand and the financial analysis, and so it was harder for him to give us numbers that, you know, would help us make a decision. So what I'm asking is, should we be asking them to go ahead and do just the financial feasibility analysis, or do it? There's also the whole other thing of, and this might be a discussion for the ad hoc committee, but if the report was much larger, it would include, you know, alternate sites and what it was going to look like and that kind of thing. Right. Anyway,
so
go
I'd
ahead,
like
Ron.
Yeah,
I could
yeah,
see
I'd like
you're
to get
ready
some
to respond.
Comments from the chair of the ad hoc committee.
It seems to the ad hoc committee that a market demand analysis is an integral element of a financial feasibility study for the facility. And presumably that's why the first deliverable, a substantial deliverable, was targeted as a market demand analysis. The challenge we have is that, in the opinion of the committee at least, the goals of the market demand analysis study were not met. So we're sort of stuck on what appears to be an incomplete necessary element, a precursor element to an economic feasibility study.
And if I can add, I think the economic feasibility relies on a lot of other determinants, where, location, haul out location, boatyard location, property acquisition, all those other things that the market analysis obviously feeds into. I think what we're looking for in the market analysis, in very simplistic terms, is, you know, we would expect X number of boats and X amount of volume of work and generate, you know, approximately X amount of revenue at, you know, because of the number of boats hauling in and out. And with that, that feeds your financial feasibility. Yeah, at some point, we, meaning the city and the fishermen's organization, are going to have to make a collective decision that, assuming we get a good market analysis out of this at the end, where we do have some sort of...
I would be opposed to the city or the fishermen's organization granting or giving them any more money until they finish the work they were supposed to do.
Noted. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing no more discussion on that topic, that concludes item C2, which is the update from our Marine Service Facilities Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee. Thank you, everyone that's been working on that, for your continued efforts. Item C3, an update from the Capital Improvement Planning Ad Hoc Committee on committee's recent activities. We've had a lot on our plate otherwise, so that committee hasn't met in the last month. As we're getting closer to the budget cycle, I think we'll pick up on that, but we're leaving this on as an agenda item so that it just doesn't disappear in any black hole. But there's nothing to report on that item since the committee didn't meet over the last month. Any questions or comments with regard to that item? Okay, seeing none, that concludes item C3 under unfinished business, which now brings us to item D, new business. D1 is the tsunami event protocols and public safety information. So it's starting to get a little late. I'm tempted to put this off, but I won't, because we put it off last month because we got a late start on our meeting. So we can run through this. It is an important item here because we had a tsunami a couple years ago, and who knows, we may have another one. So we'll get this important information out there. Eric?
Thank you. So I'll try to move through this quickly. This is more of an informational item than anything. So, yes, we have had a number of tsunami actual events and warnings over the last decade to deal with, and this item came out of, Alan, I think a request you had previously several meetings ago, some time ago, about what do we do and how do we notify boaters and how does this whole system work. So the way the whole system works is the city does have an emergency response protocol for just about everything, whether it's civil unrest or a major fire or a flood or a number of things. Tsunami is in there as well. But it doesn't, none of those plans really spell out precisely, you know, that Joe does this and Fred does this and spells out specific tasks. It does more general oversight of the event itself, including tsunamis. So where we go on tsunamis is basically depends on the level of warning that we get from the tsunami warning centers, because there's no one-size-fit-all reaction to any major public safety threat. So they get built as the threats develop. So the four levels of danger, danger levels of tsunamis, the warning levels coming out of the tsunami warning centers, and this is from worst case scenario to best case scenario. Worst case scenario is a warning, and these categories changed shortly after the Chilean earthquake we had back five or six years ago now. I guess the Japanese earthquake is going on 3 years now. So the Chilean earthquake was a couple of years before that. These protocols changed because there was a lot of confusion amongst the public about what's a watch advisory and warning, because the weather warnings that were out there, advises, watches and warnings, went a little bit differently than the tsunami in terms of degree. So they revamped the tsunami warning protocols. And what we have now is a result of that revamping. So warning is that an inundation wave is possible, something definitely is coming, and evacuation is the rule of the day. For us, if we have such a warning, depends on time, how much time we have. If it's something coming from the other side of the Pacific Ocean, as we had in the Japanese tsunami, we had hours. We had the better part of a morning and a day, and it hit in the afternoon. Plenty of warning time to get out there and make warnings and let people know what's going on. If it's from, I think, the other fault in our area that poses an immediate threat is a Cascadia fault up off of Washington and Oregon. If that lets loose, we're going to have hours. And if it's something localized that produces a tsunami, it's going to be minutes. So our action is going to depend on how much time we have. If it's something from a long distance away, we've got chances of making phone calls and letting people know. Boaters have a chance of getting their boats out in the ocean if they so choose. We'll tailor our reaction to what the threat is. If it's very short term, we're going to recommend getting out of the water, and we're going to try and get our boats out of the water if we can. Coast Guard's protocol is to go offshore to 100 fathoms. Likely we would probably take a boat out there too, because if we do have a tsunami that creates a fair amount of damage in the harbor and we've got all our boats out on trailers and now we need to get back in the water to go do something, chances are we're not going to be able to get. We don't have enough data yet. Stay tuned. In all of these events, advisory, watch, or warning, certainly in a watch or an advisory, the city is going to stand up. It's going to open up its emergency operations center, which means harbor, fire, police, public services, city administration, and possibly city council and other agencies are going to gather up at Recreation and Parks is where the EOC is, and start evaluating the threat and starting to figure out what the city's overall action plan is. Obviously, we as a harbor department, we're not alone. If there is any kind of a threat, it's going to be involved with the other departments in the city, and it certainly was on the Japanese tsunami, and there was a concerted effort to keep people out of certain areas and protect the safety of the folks. So no doubt that under those first three categories, most likely the EOC will open and action will be taken. And then the least level of warning from our advisory from the tsunami warning centers are it's an information statement. They're basically, we'll say, you know, there may be some current changes, there may be some small tidal changes, but no actions warranted, no evacuations are warranted, there's no real safety threat, it's just more of an informational thing. In the staff report is attached a tsunami warning level guide and a how to survive a tsunami brochure. We at the Harbor Department have many of these available. There's also online a lot of stuff available. The cities, coastal cities are under a mandate eventually to get tsunami ready. The city of Morro Bay is slowly getting there, and it comes down to signage and evacuation centers and evacuation routes. The county's a big part of that in that they largely come up with the signage protocol and where the signs go, and Cal Fire, the county's contracted through the state for Cal Fire. A few years ago, they determined where the tsunami inundation zones are. Basically, it's the 50-foot line to where a serious tsunami, that line, if there is a serious tsunami coming, you get above that line, and generally you're considered safe. So those maps have been generated. They're all online with the county and with Cal Fire, and the city's actions kind of follow what the county and what the state's protocols are. In terms of, like I say, with our boaters, I know Alan was concerned, you know, how do we know, how do we find out something's going on? You know, we as a Harbor Department, you know, the 50 slips we have and our peers, obviously we have some customers that we could potentially notify, but it largely depends on what the threat is, how large it is, and when it's going to be here. It would be very difficult in any kind of a tsunami scenario for us to try and individually notify every boat owner in the harbor. It would be up to the leaseholders to try and get their people. Obviously, people are right on the water right now. It's a fairly simple process. We, during the last couple tsunamis we've had, Japanese included, Chilean, and then the tsunami we had before that, a small Chilean tsunami about a decade ago now, we started down that process of notifying people in the water and letting people know on the beach that, hey, you should get out of here. Some elect to stay in place. Some choose to put to sea. I know in the Japanese tsunami, we had a number of boats in the bay get underway, a number went outside. It's a delicate balance. If we get a damaging tsunami in the springtime and it's the wind's blowing 25 to 35 knots, do you really want people to try and go offshore and get their boat out of danger? Or do you want to, is it safer for me in the harbor, even though there may be damage? So a lot of it depends on the conditions of the day. There is no one set protocol, but Generally, it's the EOC and all the city departments that are going to get together and come up with what the action plan is, what the protocols are going to be. So for the public out there, really the best thing to do is, I mean, and in this day and age with Twitter and Facebook and all the social media and cell phones, if there's a serious earthquake anywhere and there's any kind of a tsunami threat, you're going to be pretty hard-pressed to not know about it one way or another, either through your device or through somebody else. There are services you can subscribe to that do alert you in the event of large earthquakes around the world. So basically, it's stay tuned, check your news sources, check the Internet. With the city of Morro Bay, it's see if the Emergency Operations Center is open and stay tuned to the news. And the emergency alert system, I mean, that's still up. I know that part of the emergency alert system is the sirens that sound for Diablo Canyon. That's one of the reasons that system was put in place. If there is a serious tsunami threat on the way, hey, everybody, attention now, it's time to move, those sirens are going to go off and you're going to hear them. If it's less critical, that emergency alert system goes off or a large number of radio stations and television stations. If you're watching cable television, it automatically interrupts your cable television program now, and you'll see those messages. So the information age is definitely here, and there's not going to be much on
route signage prominently displayed around the harbor. I haven't seen, I don't think I've seen any of them here.
I'm not aware of any in the county. I know it's county OES that's spearheading the effort, and each county basically comes up with their own protocols, and the cities within that county follow protocol and advise and assist. It's in the county's court right now to determine signage types, inundation areas, which they have, and then next steps in terms of the individual communities, getting with the county and finding out those inundation areas and getting the signage, the adopted signage, and putting it in place. So exactly where the county is at this point on their process, I couldn't tell you.
Because I'm wondering, since we're a tourist town, and particularly the Rock parking lot in that area, I mean, the nice thing about this area is the route is real simple, right? You just go up any one of the hills, any one of the streets up the hill off the Embarcadero, and you're better. But the fact that we're a tourist town with a lot of tourists that park out at the Rock parking lot, I think, to me, it would seem important, a priority item. Is there any way we could check with the county to see where that is?
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, thanks. The second item, and this might be for Alan to answer, I remember when the Japanese tsunami hit here, the commercial fishing fleet, some of them chose to stay in their slips. A few went outside the harbor, and then a good number of them sort of were in the bay, but underway, and sort of a little parade of the boats underway that stayed in the bay. Does the CFO have any kind of protocol, or is it just basically up to each vessel owner to decide on their own?
Well, how it fell out was when you found out about it. I ended up in that middle group. I was going up and down the bay simply because I only found out the tsunami was coming half an hour before it hit. So I was just barely able to get to the boat, untie the lines, and I didn't want to go through the entrance with the possibility of being right there when some wave came along. As it turned out, it was happily a good way to go, because the guys that went out, it was blowing hard out there, and they had to go up and down all day long, and it was uncomfortable. But if it had been, a more significant tsunami, I could have, gotten in trouble along with everybody else in the bay. One thing that's important, in my opinion, to remember is that, from the city standpoint, the city facilities get injured, significant. The boats stay in the slip, and then the boat's sideways to the current, and it bends the slip or breaks the piling off. We didn't have much of that, but the problem that I see, I think if the city should notify the slip holders that it leases to, just from the point of view of preventing damage to the boats and the city facilities. And the reason that I think that it needs to be done is because the existing I tried to get on the notification after that happened, and I talked to the emergency coordinator in San Luis Obispo, and the whole automatic system is geared towards where you live. So if I live in Cambria and I'm up on a hill, they're not going to call me and warn me, and you can't move that government. It doesn't respond, you know. It can't make adjustments. So the only thing that I came away from all that thinking was, well, if you want to be notified, there ought to be some list that the city can compile, and it'll notify those people if it has a chance. And it's not the kind of thing where they'll be responsible if they didn't notify you, but it would be desirable for them to notify as many slip holders as they can. For two reasons, for their own benefit and for the people's benefit. I think that was what I got out of my whole.
And the system I think Alan's probably referring to that he made inquiries is called the reverse 911, where you know the dispatcher can on their touchscreens now they can line out an area. You know, if it's an evacuation for whatever, they can mark an area on their screen and then create the message and then send that out, and then the system automatically telephone every single one of those addresses. It relies on a hard line.
Or they text, yeah.
Or they text it, right, if that's the telephone associated with that. But you're right, it's limited. It's location-based. So if you're in the inundation zone, they're going to hit everybody in the inundation zone. You live on Condor Lookout back in the mountains, it's not going to hit you even though your boat's down in the water. And again, it comes back to, the bottom line is public human safety. And if it's a decision between... It's tough. And again, it depends on the level of the threat. With the Japanese one, what we saw in Hawaii, they knew that there was definitely something coming. Obviously, you know, it comes down to, you know, each location and how tsunamis react. Crescent City, obviously, is a tsunami magnet. The way that harbor's designed, it just doesn't take it well. Santa Cruz, not either. I mean, you get a surge going in there, and it gets skinnier and skinnier, and the wave gets bigger and bigger. Well, as a harbor manager, if I'm the harbor manager in Santa Cruz, and that's occurring, and I've got 15 boat owners that want to go down and get in their boats and go take them out to sea, do I want to encourage them to go take their boats out to sea? No, I want them out of there. Their boats, sorry, but that's just how it is. It's human safety's number one. Property becomes second. So it becomes timing and level of threat, and that's where the EOC comes in and makes those determinations. And you know, I think on the Japanese tsunami, we generally, because of the level of threat with the public, the city may attempt to keep the public off the beach, off the waterfront. If people were boat owners and they came down and said, hey, I'm Alan and I own this boat down here, I think generally, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, those boat owners were able to go down and go do something with the boat, because it wasn't like a Santa Cruz where you had 6 or 8 foot waves going through and smashing everything up. It was just a current flowing, and the city made that decision to let those folks down. So it depends on the level of the threat and what's happening with it.
Alan?
But in my particular case, if I had had a more timely warning, which could easily be gotten, you know, if government could be moved to do it, I wouldn't have arrived 20 minutes before the wave hit. I would have had plenty of time to get down there and make a decision. And I agree with Eric that saving lives is the most important thing. But on the other hand, as a boat owner, I realize that the first property to get damaged is going to be the boats and the people on the water. And in a lot of cases, nobody gets hurt, but property damage can occur. So I think it's worth initiating some kind of a response, calling slip leasers.
And with the Japanese tsunami, I mean, it, like the last few mornings where we've had this, you know, we've had to walk uphill to come up our gangway off the docks. If it would have occurred on a high tide, everything's floating off the everywhere in the bay, you know, the timing, again, it comes down to timing. Had that been the case, we knew that, I think it was like 3 to 6 foot, I think was the estimated surge height. We knew that when it was coming, the peak of it, we had a low enough tide to where We had a couple foot margin of error. Not a lot, but there's enough. Had the tide been 3 or 4 or 5 foot higher, it would have been a disaster. Everything would have floated off the tops of the pilings and boats and docks, and everything would have been everywhere.
And it's happened before.
Yeah, 64.
One thing, the Japanese earthquake, it happened late in the evening, and then I didn't watch the news or hear about it. So, you know, it's just there was room to slip through the cracks, and I did, you know.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Very good. Thank you for that report, Eric. That concludes item D1, the Tsunami Events Protocols and Public Safety Information. Takes us to item D2 under new business, cancellation of the January 2015 Harbor Advisory Board meeting. And as our board members know, typically we've canceled what the January and the July meeting. I'm going to make a recommendation to us that we have our January meeting. I discussed this with Eric somewhat. The reason that I would like to have a January meeting is because, we have a very long pending list, and we've been getting a lot done. We're in the midst of the review of our rules and regs, and I don't want to lose the momentum there as well. But we've got a lot going on, and we're getting a lot done, and I just want to keep that going. So when I spoke with Eric, our harbor director, about the schedule for January, had some concerns because obviously the first Thursday of January is the first of the year, and it's a holiday, so that wouldn't work. The 8th is problematic as well, but the next Thursday, which looks like it's in the middle of the month, but January is a 5-week month, is the 15th. And if we had a meeting on the 15th, that would work to where our February meeting would still be 3 weeks away. So that would allow us to have a January and a February meeting. They wouldn't be too impacted together. We would miss the holiday. And it still puts some pressure on our harbor director's schedule. But maybe we could, and he doesn't look too excited about it. That's
call for a special meeting on January 15th. He can do so with proper Brown Act noticing, which is 72 hours. That follows with Jeff, the chair of the Harbor Advisory Board. It's under his purview to call for a special meeting. Obviously, if he calls for one in the middle of nowhere day where everybody's gone, he's not going to get very many people. He doesn't have to have your permission, nor does the city council have to grant the mayor permission for a particular date that he may choose for a meeting. It's good that if we've got some consensus of our elected body or of our advisory body here of a second meeting, possibly a date, but it's up to the chairman to choose such a date and set that meeting. So if I would suggest that if there's consensus, cancel this meeting. If there's consensus to try and do a meeting in January with a suggestion on a certain date or dates, doesn't have to be on a Thursday necessarily. That's just our meeting schedule. If it's a special meeting, it can be any date. Jeff works with the harbor director, and we determine what date might work from a staff standpoint, from an availability of the facility standpoint, from an AGP standpoint, and see if we can pick a day, providing Harbor Advisory Board wants to go there.
Thank you, Eric. So at this point, I'd like to get some input from the Harbor Board. You've heard what I've had to say about it. I would like to have one in January for the reasons that I mentioned before. Is there anyone that that doesn't want to have one in January?
I care less.
So Gene's okay either way.
Well, I think it's a good idea to keep working. You know, I think it would be too big of a...
Lynn?
Seeing as how our packets now are up to 30 and 40 pages for every meeting, I think if we skip one, are we going to have 70 or 80 pages for one meeting? I'll go along with the January meeting.
Okay, Bill?
I concur. I'll go along for a January meeting.
And Ron?
Likewise.
Okay. So, what I will do then, as your chair, is I'll work with Eric. I'll shoot for that week. I'll shoot for that Thursday, just because it seems to make sense to me from a calendar standpoint, and we're used to meeting on Thursdays. But if for some reason that doesn't work because of AGP or scheduling, we'll look at something that will work. So I'll work with Eric on that.
Still got to cancel.
So we still need, it does fall, our regularly scheduled meeting falls on a national holiday, New Year's Day. So I'll look for a motion to cancel the regularly scheduled meeting of January 2015.
I'll make that motion.
Moved by Gene.
I'll second.
Seconded by Bill. Any further discussion? No. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Nope, so that passes. And we are at declaration of future agenda items.
Do you want to see the list? So what we've been doing, at least what we're trying to do now, again, sort of following city council and city manager protocol, which we've been doing, you know, Jeff and I work and trying to determine what's coming up next based on advisory board input, and yeah, we want this here and we'd like to see that there. We've created a spreadsheet of sorts, a list of the pending agenda items that Jeff gets when we issue an agenda. So we've got a little more time than a few days before the meeting when I'm creating the agenda. Hey, Jeff, what do you think? We'll work a little more towards planning it. With that, I mean, there's a fair amount of things on there. Do you want to go over the laundry list again? I mean, personally, I think we got plenty on there to cover. One of the things we need to cover if we do that January meeting or February is State Park Marina. I believe we've already got that declared as future agenda. State Parks, if assuming we continue forward in that operating agreement, they want to hold a public hearing on a study they've done on possibilities of moving forward in a concession-type contract on the marine operation, and they've got had a study done on that, so they want to do a public hearing on that, and they've elected to work with us and do it as a Harbor Advisory Board meeting, so that may go in January or February. So we don't need anything to add to the agenda if someone's got something really burning they want to bring up.
Right, so we've got that, and of course the continuation of our rules and regs. Is there a declaration of any future agenda items by any of the board members? And obviously we wouldn't necessarily have to do this in the January-February meeting, but if there's anything on your mind that you'd like to put on the list right now, we of course can do that as well. Ron?
I'd just like to have a clarification of what the...
For the place to begin with, I think now we've gotten back on a good path here, and then we'll go to the next step. I think next steps for me, now that we've got definitions, are going to be the rules and regulations that we looked at earlier, Muni Code, things that, and maybe kind of like we took it in chunks, I don't think we're going to tackle the whole rules and regulations, the whole Muni Code in one night. It's going to be a section or sections that make sense to kind of put together and get the same kind of broad input, and then with the things that we want to do and the things that you identify as needing to be done, we'll identify some language, some things to look at, some things to eliminate, and take it step by step. So I'm probably looking at least a couple more meetings of the general rules and regulations in Muni Code.
Insofar as the general is concerned, are you comfortable flagging some of the provisions of the general code for us that you think are, you know, particularly important, or would you not like to do it that way?
No, absolutely. That's one of my intentions, is the things that we feel. I mean, our rules and regulations, it needs a general reorganization and putting back into a little different order. I think it's a little scattered. Not from a changing content, but just changing order and organization. I absolutely would intend to flag things that, yeah, this is where we have a problem, we need this, this is something we're lacking, and definitely bring up things and not just say, here's the rules, what do you think? Definitely not. Definitions kind of lent itself to that, as a couple I added in, a few preconceived notions that have been hanging, like the seaworthy thing. That kind of lent itself to that. But no, the rest of them, I think, things that we definitely identify. So, you know, as you guys move forward, I guess it's incumbent upon you to look at the rules and regulations in Muni Code and see if there's things you want to flag. And if you want to give me that input prior to the meeting so that I can make sure I've got everything I need. I mean, it's going to be tough to give everybody a whole copy of the whole Muni Code, so that's why I think we're going to have to still take it in sections, just because, I mean, like we identified earlier, there are different areas that speak to other areas, so we've got to be cognizant of that, but it's going to be impossible to do the whole Muni Code and the whole rules and regs at once.
All right. Anything else for future agenda items? Nope. Okay. That concludes item E, which will bring us to item F, the adjournment. Before we adjourn, I want to say a couple of things. It's 9:07, so we've been here for 3 hours, but you guys got a lot accomplished. So I want to thank you all for your perseverance and your dedication, and you can feel proud of yourself. I'm proud of you because you guys did a good job. And I think we've had a very productive year. This is our last meeting of the year 2014. I think each board member can also feel good about the fact that we've got a lot accomplished this year. And we'll continue that momentum. Lastly, thank you to Polly for staying so late. And thank you, Polly, for all the work that you've done for us and continue to do for us. We appreciate it. And Merry Christmas to everybody and happy holidays. Because as this airs throughout December, it's the holiday season. So I wish everybody the happiest of holidays and a Merry Christmas and a safe New Year. Anybody want to make any sentimental comments since I opened the door for that before we adjourn?
Don't forget the boat parade on Saturday night.
The boat parade coming up the first Saturday, which will be, what, the 6th, 7th? Is it the 7th?
6th.
The 6th. The 6th. So December 6th. Head out there to the waterfront and enjoy our waterfront. So with that, I will look for a motion to adjourn. It's moved by Gene. Second. Seconded by Ellen. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right, thank you.